Happy Christmas from Radio Arian. Have a pro-white Christmas and a diversity-free new year. And remember, a kebab is not just for Christmas. You're listening to The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Highmark at RadioArian.com.
Hello, comrades. This is your host of The Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach, and I'm here today with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson to discuss something that we've discussed on the show before, but it's something of, I think, huge importance, and that is the Korean Peninsula. It's been in the news a lot lately, especially with the DPRK now being able to hit the Great Satan, which I'm sitting in right now, as is Dr. Johnson, with a nuclear weapon, which is interesting that Rex Tillerson has now said, "We will talk with the North Koreans with no preconditions." Before, there were all these conditions for negotiations, and as soon as a country has the ability to bloody Zog's nose, then they kind of ramp that back a little bit and are now just saying, let's open a line of communication. But we're here today to talk about Korean nationalism and how it relates to the geopolitical struggle and in terms of history. Now, you know, one of the things just to kick off before I tap in Dr. Johnson is this Korean idea, and I apologize if I have any Korean listeners, the principle of Daniel Minjok, which is one people. It's very similar to the, you know, kind of Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Führer, National Socialist principle of, you know, one people, one nation, one leader. And this is not actually just a North Korean philosophy. A BBC poll actually asked all the different people in a bunch of different countries about what factor self-identity in terms of race, you know, how important that was. And South Korea, out of polled nations, actually gave the highest ratio of what their self-identity meant in terms of race and culture. So this is a kind of Korean phenomenon. It's not, you know, just a DPRK thing, but it's a very strong racial nationalism. And this plays into geopolitics today. And no one better to talk about international affairs, especially those in part of the old Soviet bloc, of which the DPRK would be a part of, than Dr. Matt Johnson. So, Dr. Johnson, how are you doing today?
Well, yes, I'm sorry for our technical problems. I don't sound as wonderful as I normally do. And we're this part of the Great Satan. We are completely snowed in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Have you heard my latest Orthodox nationalist?
I have to say, I'm going to be driving this weekend, so I have it saved and ready to listen to for those long hours on the road, but I haven't gotten to hear it yet. So give me and the listeners a little bit of a spark notes.
Well, that's actually, it's relevant. It has to do with South Korea. And I know that you've been very positive about the racial doctrines and some of the nationalist stuff in the North. And I recorded a segment on General Park Chung-hee in the South, who was an explicit social nationalist in his ideology. For all the talk about North Korea, the average American can name all three dictators of the North. No one can name anything about the South. The fact is that General Park Chung-hee was a national socialist who took a fourth world backwater and turned it into a first world powerhouse in 18 years. And he did this with a state-run economy with 2 5-year plans. And he was abandoned by the United States. The U.S., the CIA murdered him in 1979. And the Carter administration was had agreed to pull all American troops out of the peninsula, just as Kim Il-sung and the Chinese were discussing an invasion of the South. There's no doubt. And Park Chung-hee, as well as the Korean troops fighting in Vietnam, which there were 300,000 of them, were in full agreement that the U.S. was not an anti-communist power. And for about a decade, so long as the new Hitler, as they called them, was in power in the South, they leaned to the North. The U.S. and NATO leaned to North Korea. And as the Pueblo incident proves. And the deeper I get into South Korea in the 60s and 70s, not only do I see a miraculous economic development under National Socialist principles called the New Community Movement under General Park, but I see almost complete incomprehension. I mean, unless you specialize in the peninsula, you've never heard of the guy. And he was president of South Korea for 18 years. And the man who murdered him was head of the Korean CIA, said just before he was hanged that the CIA told him to kill him, that the U.S. was leaning to the north, diplomatically speaking, and that the student riots in South Korea, including the communists, were being financed out of the American embassy. So here's a guy with nothing left to lose, just going to be hanged for the murder of Park, says all this about the United States. I've been talking to the granddaughter of the commander of South Korean troops in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And this general, General Che, was the world specialist in guerrilla warfare. He led the skeleton division of South Korea during the Korean War. And that's why he was chosen to fight the Viet Cong, because he specialized in their methods. General Che came back to South Korea and General Park and said, the U.S. are deliberately losing this war. Every 5 minutes, they blame him for some massacre somewhere, some war crime. General Westmoreland, who was counsel on foreign relations, all the elite groups, was deliberately not using him, not talking to him, marginalizing the huge army that Korea had in Vietnam. And he finally storms out. As the U.S. eventually put sanctions on South Korea, because this guy was a social nationalist and had thrown the bankers out. Of course, he nationalized the Korean bank, which had been set up by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in 1945. He created a new currency, the won, in 1962, throwing the bankers out. That's when the U.S. turned on him, and so all this military aid all of a sudden dried up, and they were demanding dialogue with the North. But when General Che comes back from Vietnam, he says the U.S. is deliberately losing this war. They know everything we're doing. Someone is telling the Viet Cong what we're going to do. The Viet Cong were scared to death of the South Koreans, not the United States. And in protest of the clear movement to the North from the American government and military, he slowly withdrew his troops before the fall of Saigon in 1975. Now, with all the talk about North Korea, no one has any idea that that happened. And I'm here to set that straight once and for all.
Well, you know, and Dr. Johnson, I think it's a very important thing to talk on, because this is something that I've actually read about a little bit before, and I just pulled up to refresh my memory, and it looks like it's kind of amazing, the idea of shooting on October 26, 1979, General Park being assassinated, along with four presidential guards. And they basically said, you know, under investigation afterwards, that that General Park was an obstacle to democracy, and that's why he had to be assassinated. And it's very interesting. It's always about democracy, isn't it? Like, we don't care about democracy when it comes to our allies, like Saudi Arabia, the largest funder of terrorism around the entire world. We don't care about democracy then. We care about democracy when it goes against what's good for the bankers and what's good for the Jews, essentially, in terms of their New World Order agenda. You know, if a leader rejects what happens in terms of actually wants to put his people first, well, then he's anti-democratic and he has to go, whether that's in Ukraine, whether that's in South Korea, whether that's the regime changes that have happened around the globe. I've got to say, the CIA does not have a very good retirement policy. It's got to be kind of hard, I imagine, nowadays to recruit people. I mean, the murder of Colonel Gaddafi, the overthrow of Saddam, the overthrow of Mubarak, the invasions that we've done around the entire world, especially meddling in Latin America. The CIA does not have a very good retirement policy. They seem to, whenever someone actually, you know, works to be a nationalist for their people, they end up killing them. And they do so very publicly. It's just, in this case, the assassin was actually caught and then was forced to face justice, which is something that rarely happens, sadly.
Well, and his words were very, very clear. I concluded my talk yesterday by saying, how in the hell can you protest this man? Incomes were doubling every few years. Every university he built the first world economy out of absolutely nothing. hospitals. There were in the early 60s, there were 1,000 small manufacturing businesses founded every year. The economy grew by 10 times under his control, partially because and then he went to the bankers and he forced interest rates to the absolute bottom. He didn't care what the original loan was. You had to pay 1% the most and no compounding. That's how, and he canceled debts all over the place. So he's the son of a poor farmer. And that's why he always remained this populist leader. And the fact is that whether you have East Asia or Latin America, these military dictators were our people. So many of them called themselves national socialists. Now, Park's big problem is that he said his three role models in Europe were Napoleon, Bismarck, and Hitler. I guess he didn't get the memo that the U.S. would really turn on him if he said something like that. And the New Community Movement was an expressly national socialist movement, and the Eastern Constitution was NS to the absolute core. I can't find any difference between Adolf Hitler, Mussolini, and Park in any regard in terms of their domestic policies, in terms of return to the tradition, family, money. I mean, the man was, and he showed how it worked. How do you take this? I think it was the fifth poorest country on the planet when he took over in 1961, and it was the 14th most powerful economy in the world when he was murdered in 1979. That's what National Socialism can do, period.
Well, and just to tap into what you're saying, I'm just looking at some of these figures here. Some of his reforms included bringing 24-hour electricity in 1964, which was huge because previously the majority of businesses and homes only had a few hours of electricity. He created the state-owned Pohang Iron and Steel Company, which provided cheap steel, which allowed them to build the first automobile factories and shipyards in South Korea. And they were able to meet their targets under the five-year plans with loans on easy terms of repayment, tax cuts, easy licensing, and subsidies to be able to grow South Korean industry. I mean, the idea of actually putting industry first for your people, which then of course creates jobs, and ensuring that there's a higher standard of living for your people. I mean, this is the sort of thing that isn't really talked about, because nationalist policies, I mean, right now in the United States, with income inequality at its highest rate since probably the Gilded Age, just to be able to look, there's money being made. I mean, I was just listening, my listeners know I listen to NPR a lot for rage fuel, but also to understand what's going on in the world from a leftist perspective, and then to kind of sift through all that. But talking about the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been made on the stock market, probably trillions of dollars at this point, since Trump came into office, and where's all that money? I mean, just one look at the Republican tax plan just goes to show that they're just going to try and concentrate wealth in the hands of the already wealthy, instead of having nationalist policies where you actually benefit local businesses, national businesses, and your workers, because your workers, whether they're in modern day a computer coder or a graphics designer or a farmer or a logger or an electrical lineman, I mean, whatever that job is, white collar, blue collar, these are the people that actually make things, the people that actually create the wealth for the nation. And while business owners deserve to be able, for their investment and their risk, deserve to be able to make money from their profits, the people that actually, make things happen deserve to be able to have economic prosperity. Like, they deserve a fruit of their labor. And that's totally denied right now in Western, quote unquote, democracies and these capitalist systems. That's totally denied to the average worker. So the idea of a leader actually putting his people first and investing in the infrastructure in his nation. I mean, if you can imagine, so if General Park invested a massive program to boost the amount of power created and the amount of electricity and the lines and all the things that go into that, just compare that to the United States, where our infrastructure would now take over $3.2 trillion to fix, right? To just get it up to standard. We've got hundreds of bridges that are in danger of falling down. Our roads have fallen apart. And places like Romania have faster internet than we do here in the United States. I mean, when it comes to a 21st century infrastructure, we have decaying water lines that poison people in places like West Virginia. We've got a horrible access to good health care for the majority of the population. and we're falling behind in every single regard. But a government, nationalist leadership, is supposed to put the people in the nation first. That's why you invest in the people, so they can have a better standard of living, so they can produce more to bring more fruits of their labor to the nation. I mean, that seems like common sense to me, Father Dr. Johnson. But why is it in America? Is this totally ignored?
When this guy took over in 1961, he took over partially because of the extreme oligarchy that had developed. Again, being the son of a poor farmer under the Japanese occupation, he was automatically a nationalist and a socialist. So when he first takes over, military man, he takes a handful of the conglomerate CEOs and throws them in jail. They owe taxes. He had some pretext. And he said, here's what's going to happen. He said, you're going to play ball with me. He actually did this personally. You're going to play ball with me. You know, you're going to diversify. You're going to focus on exports. You're going to have employment for life for your workers. As you know, South Korea was famous for that. You're going to increase wages, and you're going to repress interest rates. If you don't, I'm going to keep you in here. And you know, if you don't, your competition will. And if you play ball, you will be a part of the planning process. And even get subsidies. All you got to do is play ball with me. And not only did they say yes, but the guys he didn't throw in prison all of a sudden discover all these back taxes that they owed the government, and money poured into the government's coffers. But then incomes are doubling every few years. Of course, you had a job for life. 20% of the budget was not for defense, but 20% of the budget was for education. So when riots erupt in the late 60s, I'm saying, what are these kids protesting? What could you possibly be upset about? They're coming from the universities that he built, coming from the families that he made wealthy because in the new economy. Well, the guy that killed Park said, I'm not telling you where they're coming from. They're being organized by the American embassy, who, because of his rejection of the American banking paradigm, had to die. And the good news is another military dictator took his place. So the discovery, and look at what South Korea is today. I can say the same thing about Taiwan, the exact same thing. A social nationalist, military dictator, ruled with an iron fist, and everyone loved him. How could you possibly protest a guy like Chung Hee Park when you could actually watch your country, your own opportunities are going through the roof? Inflation became a problem because disposable incomes were going up so fast. How could you possibly, what do you have to complain about?
Just to touch on real quick. When he took power, I'm kind of amazed by this. The per capita income in South Korea was only $72. That's it, $72.
And then, what is it? 1979. What is it today? It was going up so fast that his bank, which was run by a military man, and he created a and by the way, when he instituted the new currency, the won, he kept it secret from the Americans until the absolute last second. Because he knew the crap he was going to get for this. And so when he throws it was essentially run directly from New York, the old bank, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, wrote the law, and he sent one of his guys who had financial acumen in there and sent him on a boat back to Hawaii. He knew the U.S. was going to go orbital, and they did. And so we look at the Korean Peninsula now. We see this incredible South Korea, which came from the vision of one man. He did it partially because you had a completely homogenous South Korean people who had a strong sense of mission, and a part of his new community movement was a strong sense of optimism that we are going to do this. And he's doing this all with this massive threat to his north, being financed by the Soviet Union and having aid stripped from him. The U.S. was, there wasn't much aid during his rule. They rejected him. And when Saigon fell in 1975 and the U.S. had lost in Vietnam, that's when Kim Il-sung planned an invasion of South Korea, gambling that, well, the U.S. is not going to get involved in another war in Asia now. And so Chung Hee Park centralized power very fast. There were tunnels that he found from North Korea under the DMZ. He had just been there was an assassination attempt in 1968 of a North Korean agent. And he saved South Korea from this massive invasion that the Chinese were going to engage in. He created the Yushin Constitution, a centralized power, all of this. For that reason, and the U.S. condemned him and put sanctions on South Korea.
Well, and one of the most important things to remember, of course, because as nationalists, the economic issues, of course, are incredibly important. But on the same time, when it comes to preserving culture, and he actually went ahead and he abolished the use of Chinese characters and got education exclusively teaching the Korean languages in the 60s and 70s. This was part of a policy of really reaffirming Korean identity, because, of course, there's been occupation of the Korean Peninsula by different Asian powers for a very long time. So one of the most important things is to be able to root, especially your youth, in your identity, in your language, in your culture, and your customs. And there was a huge amount of support for these sort of cultural programs to be able to reaffirm Korean identity. And that's one, I mean, can you imagine a Western government doing that? You know, actually really encouraging a study of your language and your culture in a positive and healthy way. I mean, yeah, I was just reading an article on altright.com about in Hungary, how the government has put a lot of money into the Christmas market to be able to support the small craftsmen, to create actual Hungarian goods, to be able to celebrate the culture. And their Christmas market that only a few years ago was very small is now going to have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands, probably over a million visitors this year. And it's celebration of Christendom. It's a celebration of Hungary, and it's a celebration of really the unique culture that the people have. And that's what nationalist governments do, that they don't just say and use words and decrees when it comes to the nation. They actually invest in the people and the culture to ensure that the culture remains unique, to be able to reject this globalization, the McDonald's-ification, essentially, of the individual, of the nation, and instead supporting that cultural identity. This is something we also see, of course, in the DPRK, a very strong commitment to the cultural institutions of the Korean people. I mean, and the opposition, of course, to foreigners getting citizenship is something shared on both sides of the Korean Peninsula, because it's a land for Koreans. While there is a very tragic divide now in between those in the DPRK and those in South Korea, on both sides of the line, you know, most Koreans view themselves still as one people. This is a temporary break in the unity of a strong people with a very strong culture, a very strong history and identity, that also they base policies on racial purity. Both North and South Korea, I mean, at this point, North Korea has a stronger racial policy, as outlined in the book, The Cleanest Race, which is available on Amazon for anyone who wants to get it. Really outline, I've talked about it before, how the DPRK has probably the strongest racial policies currently out of really any country, and of course also refuses to recognize Israel as a legitimate government, one of the very small number of countries that does that. But both sides of the Korean Peninsula oppose racial mixing due to the fact it destroys the unity of the people. Dr. Johnson, maybe you want to talk a little bit about that in terms of South Korea's racial policies.
Well, on the New Community Movement, it was absolutely identical to what you had described. This is part of the reason that he was condemned with such viciousness. Now, he was very anti-communist, and of course, this is the era of Kim Il-sung, don't forget. So he was playing Russia and China off against each other, the Soviet Union and China off against each other. But the New Community Movement and the New Village Movement, which were, of course, connected, are these broad ideological struggles to maintain. It's exactly what you're saying. It is identical in every single respect. It's part of the Korean way. As of right now, I'm not seeing unification would be extremely difficult because of how wealthy South Korea is and how poor North Korea is. Clearly, the North Korean experiment was not successful. The South Korean experiment was. And the big difference is that, there was no state-owned businesses. Foreign trade was in state hands and heavy industry was in state hands. Otherwise, it was a public-private partnership continuously. The U.S. has destroyed that in the 1980s. And employment for life, of course, is gone now, too. These are the things that piss the U.S. off. So it drives me insane that the U.S. somehow fought Marxism in the Cold War. There is no such thing. 1979, Jimmy Carter refuses to recognize Taiwan and recognizes Peking, Communist China, after all their murders. And, you know, so communist powers in you know, throughout in Latin America, anti-communist powers in Latin America and East Asia are outraged. I thought the U.S. was on. They were not. And so for all the crap about North Korea now, all the propaganda, we don't really have a lot of solid information what's being done in North Korea. We know most of it's garbage, but we don't know that for certain. South Korea, we know because it was open. And so you had slightly different economic system, just more private enterprise. And you see the difference between the two. But Park recognized that small businesses and medium-sized businesses were really the engine of growth. And that's where he permitted zero-interest loans and all these other things. And this is what the U.S. was screaming about. They had sanctions on South Korea in the 1970s. They were financing these rioters who couldn't even give you an abstract democracy. We want free elections. Why would he run for election? He didn't do enough for you? I mean, it's you know, Iraq, Libya, Syria, these countries were on the cusp of first world growth. And the U.S. had to destroy them. They need these countries, poverty-stricken exporters of primary materials and women. I guess that's really it. And that's what will satisfy the oligarchy in New York, in Washington, in London, in Brussels. And I'm reading this about this man, and I'm going to have a stroke one of these days. I'm absolutely so outraged at the American behavior. It was not an anti-communist movement at all. The real anti-communists who were successful economically and racially were condemned, and sanctions were placed on their countries.
Well, and that's actually, as we're coming to the end of the show, because this is a topic we go over incredibly, do you want to maybe touch on something for the listeners of the Orthodox Nationalists have heard before, but it's always good to bring up the U.S. support for the Soviet Union and Communist China, just very briefly, you know, as we're coming to the close here, the fact that during the Cold War, it was not a Cold War. It was Jews on both sides from Moscow to New York and Washington to be pushing the exact same agenda when the Soviet Union collapsed. That was simply the Jews closing up shop of one of their foreign embassies, essentially, as they continue their stranglehold over the West. But can you just mention real briefly the direct support that the U.S. government gave to the Soviet Union during the Cold War?
Anthony Sutton has a 3-volume work where he shows actual receipts from all American conglomerates, how they built the heavy industry of the USSR. It was electrified by GE. Amoco and the Rockefellers built their oil wells. There's a big mining firm in Alaska that built their mining in Europe. Henry Ford built the largest truck plant in the world in eastern Ukraine under Stalin. Everything that the Soviet Union had built came from the United States. And some of this was done as the U.S. was in the middle of a depression. How can that be a war? How can there be a threat here? Obviously, there was no war. There was no confrontation. But they certainly were going to jump to Stalin's side when Hitler rose. Now you have an enemy. So everything the USSR was, and then continuously, their economic policies failed, the U.S. would bail them out with food aid. This goes from their support of the Red Armies during the Civil War all the way up to the 1970s. And then, as you said, no more profit could be sucked out of that old capital, and so the Jews fled the coup, and that was it. It fell to pieces. You're exactly right, and it's outrageous, but this is all an open secret.
Well, and exactly. Let's remember just real briefly, if it hadn't been for the fact that the Red Army was using, you know, American bullets, American jeeps, American tanks, using American bandages and eating American beans, the Third Reich would have triumphed in the Second World War. And we would be living in a nationalist world. We would not be living in this capitalist Lovecraftian hellscape that we currently inhabit. It's capitalism and communism working together against nationalism on both the left, the right, and the center, that anything that goes against globalism, against the Jewish power structure, against the international banks, capitalists and communists will always find the ability to shake hands with one another to be able to destroy nationalism. This is why this is a worldwide struggle. What happens in Korea, what happens in Palestine or in Syria or in Latin America might seem like it's a far away from our, you know, white nationalist comrades in Kentucky or Tennessee or Montana. But this all impacts us because this is a worldwide struggle against globalism, against capitalism, against communism for a world of free and sovereign peoples. This struggle has been going on for centuries, millennia, and it's one that we have to keep fighting until final victory. So, Dr. Johnson, thank you so much, as always, for your insight. I always appreciate having you on. And to you, my dear listeners, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. And remember, you know, we are fighting the same enemy on the same barricades with nationalists around the globe. So keep fighting, keep struggling, And remember to always hail victory.
You've been listening to The Daily Traditionalist on Radio Air.